It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday marked 1 year since President Mohamed Morsi came to power in Egypt, and Egyptians responded to the anniversary by taking to the streets in the largest protest since he took office.
Today, after opposition protesters set fire to Morsi's party headquarters and the reports of at least 16 deaths, the Egyptian military issued an ultimatum to Morsi's government. You have 48 hours to come to a compromise with the opposition or the military will intervene.
Here to tell us what this ultimatum means and what the future of Morsi's government might look like is Marina Ottaway. She's senior scholar for the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Marina, thank you for joining us.
You are very welcome.
Now, what message did the Egyptian military send with this ultimatum?
Okay, first of all, I think I read the ultimatum somewhat differently from the way you reported it, in the sense that I think it's an ultimatum to both sides, not just to Morsi. That is, to both sides of saying, you find a way to move forward, or we will tell you how to move forward. Essentially, we will design the way forward unless you guys cannot compromise.
That's interesting, because I've seen some reporting saying this was a message to the government, and protesters were celebrating that the military was going to intervene in part on their side.
I don't think so. I have not. The statement is rather vague. The way I have read it is it's not exactly what the military, what the protesters wanted, because the protesters wanted the military to intervene on their behalf, force Morsi out of office, and essentially hand power to a personality from the secular camp. The military so far has not said that that's what they want. They told everybody, you get together, you find a way to move forward, or we are going to tell you how to move forward. What that way exactly entails, we don't know at this point, but I doubt that the military is simply going to take power. There are many reasons. One, first, they did not like being in power in the last 2 years. They don't like the political criticism. Secondly, they know that they can lose a lot in terms of U.S. military aid. The United States does not approve of coup d'etat, and this would be a coup d'etat if they depose Morsi, from a government they consider to be legitimately elected. And the United States believes that Morsi was legitimately elected. So the military could stand to lose a lot of military aid. And thirdly, I think it would be very dangerous for the military itself to take sides. It's different to say, you know, knocking heads and say, you guys have to compromise. Very different to take sides in favor of one faction rather than the other, because there are both secular and Islamist people in the ranks and file of the military.
Right. So it's maybe misleading to speak of what the military will do, because there are, as you say, different viewpoints within the military, just as within the rest of Egyptian society.
Yes. I think the military, for the time being, will try to tell everybody, you find a way forward, or we will tell you, which probably entail, I would expect it to entail some sort of saying, you have to hold the negotiations, you have to form you have to renegotiate some of the articles of the Constitution, you have probably to have a more inclusive cabinet, and I think they'll say you have to move towards holding parliamentary elections as soon as possible, and probably new presidential elections as well down the road, but not deposing, it will not include deposing Morsi right away. At least that would be my, I think that's the most probable outcome.
Now, we've seen some ministers resigning from Egypt's parliament. Do people think that this government is on the brink of collapsing?
Well, it's certainly in a very tenuous situation. There have been the Morsi had made an effort to include in the cabinet people who are not hardcore Islamists, and of course those are the ones that are getting out at this point. I mean, I think Morsi knows that he has to make some concessions to the opposition. I don't think the Muslim Brotherhood, and keep in mind it's not just Morsi, it's the entire Muslim Brotherhood, at this point is taking into consideration the idea of just surrendering power.
And now, even if the Morsi government and the Muslim Brotherhood make concessions that the military wants, is that going to be enough for the people who are protesting right now?
The question is not so much for the people who are protesting, it's for the leadership of the opposition. We have to see. They will not, if they hold out the hope that the military will just hand over power to them. They will, they will play very hard ball. If they think that the military is serious by saying you have to compromise, then I think probably they will compromise, because without the backing of the military, they cannot seize power themselves.
Now, there's this ultimatum, 48 hours, make something happen, come to some terms. Say 48 hours passes and both sides haven't met and haven't done that. What, apart from just taking over, what else does the military have in its pocket to punish them for not reaching a deal?
Oh, I think the military will probably convoke talks, convoke a national dialogue. It might appoint a committee to revise the most articles of the Constitution, might enact an election law and set the timetable for elections. These are all things that it could do without taking the extreme position of forcing Morsi out of power immediately. In other words, without carrying out an outright military coup d'etat. It could be, if you want, a military coup of sorts, but it could still essentially work from behind the elected authorities.
In closing, Egypt's military has a long history of being involved in the political system. It's hard to overgeneralize maybe, but how do Egyptians feel about the military intervening in politics in any way?
Well, I think they are very divided, because if you look at the ranks of the opposition, some members of the opposition, for example, Mohamed El Baradei, who is one of the most best known figures in the opposition, has told the military squarely, if the situation, if Egypt threatens to be engulfed into chaos, then it is your duty to intervene. So it was a pretty clear call for military intervention. There have been Egyptians passing out petitions asking the military to intervene. At the same time, liberals, the more liberals element and the revolutionary youth, the members of the youth movements, are very much opposed to a new military intervention. In other words, the Egyptians would be very divided in their reaction to the military takeover at this point. And of course, the Muslim Brotherhood would be very much opposed if it takes the form of forcing Morsi to resign immediately.
We'll be keeping an eye on this, and so will you, I'm sure. Marina, thank you very much for joining us today.
You are most welcome.
That's Marina Ottaway, senior scholar for the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars.
After the headlines, we'll be talking about only children. Now, Rob, you're not an only child.
Nope, I do have a brother. You are an only child, though.
I am, as a matter of fact, and I'm almost perfectly normal, I'm glad to say. And according to our next guest, I'm not alone. She's out to bust stereotypes about only children after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up tomorrow on the Joy Cardine Show, Joy talks with the director of Wisconsin's new Office of Skills Development about closing the state's skills gap between the workers that are out there and the jobs that are available. That's tomorrow at 6 on the Joy Cardine Show.
Now here's Kristen Durst with a check of the latest headlines.
There's a makeshift memorial of flower bouquets and American flags at a fire station in Prescott, Arizona, where an elite team of firefighters was based. 19 of the 20 members of the team were killed yesterday when a windblown wildfire suddenly swept toward them. The one firefighter who survived had been moving the team's truck at the time. It's the biggest rally seen in years outside the Texas state capitol. Thousands of demonstrators gathered there today, most of them expressing their opposition to new abortion restrictions that were derailed last week by a Democratic filibuster and raucous protests. Governor Scott Walker has vetoed his own plan to charge state workers more for health insurance if they smoke. Walker's executive state budget would have required state workers who smoke to pay $50 more per month for health insurance. But Walker used his partial veto powers to erase that plan. Walker's veto message says the new federal guidance on tobacco surcharges was issued after he drew up the fee plan and would make the program too cumbersome.
Thanks, Kristen. And there's more news coming up at 4:30. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time.
When it comes to only children, three words come up over and over again: lonely, selfish, and maladjusted. But our next guest is here to bust only child myths and talk about the benefits of growing up a singleton. And for parents, having just one kid might be the solution to the ongoing conflict between the demands of parenthood and modern realities.
And we want to hear from you. Are you an only child? Or maybe you're a parent who made the decision to stop at one. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email at talk@WPR.org. Tell us about your experience.
Lauren Sandler is a journalist and an author and an only child herself. Her new book is called One and Only: The Freedom of Having an Only Child and the Joy of Being One. Lauren, welcome.
Hello, fellow only.
So the standard line right out there that we hear over and over, only children are lonely, they're selfish, they're messed up. So as a culture, are we still buying that?
We really are, and it's amazing to me that we are, because as we know, we discontinued the rest of the stereotypes in the 90s, but this one remained somehow. It survived political correctness. It also survived hundreds of studies done over decades and decades disproving that we are lonely, selfish, and maladjusted, and yet it continues.
So why do you think those labels have such staying power when we've evolved in so many other ways?
Well, I have puzzled over this for the 3 years that I was reporting this book. I think that three elements are in play. One was, when we were evolving as a species, we needed to have more of us to survive. And then as we evolved into agrarian humans, we needed more of us to thrive. Children were a labor force, and the more you had, the more you could make it. But then the Industrial Revolution hit, of course, and then suddenly children began to cost more instead of earning more. And meanwhile, women's roles were starting to change. And obviously, they've changed radically. But I really think that we still haven't really caught up to notions of what women's freedom really means. And so to be saying you need to mother more all the time keeps things at least somewhat in the box that it's been for a while, which doesn't mean that you can't be much more than a mother if you have more than one child. But to have this social messaging to tell us to have more children all the time, it does seem to be that's sort of an engine behind it.
Well, and as we said, you're an only child who grew up and decided to have only one child. How did
so
your family
far, at least.
So far, so that could change. There's going to be a sequel
I
to your
have
book.
A few years to change my mind. People keep joking, "Oh, you've got a sequel in mind."
Okay, Lauren, you can't cave now. You wrote this book.
Right?
You're in. But I mean, how did you make those choices? How did your mom make that choice?
Well, for my mom, I think it was easier for her to make this choice in the mid-70s than it is right now. You know, it was a time of radical feminism and strong environmentalism. People were really redefining their lives in terms of family planning and population in ways that got some public support, at least in certain zip codes. You know, I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so that's pretty, I think, familiar territory. And in parts of Wisconsin, you know, the sort of university areas where such ideas were smiled upon instead of frowned upon. And right now, it doesn't really feel that way so much anymore. So her feeling at the time was she and my dad lived in an apartment, and they didn't want to move. And she did great work that she loved, and she didn't want to do less of it. And they wanted to live somewhere where they could pop up and get a good cookie at 9 o'clock at night if they felt like it, and have a little bit of spontaneity. And, you know, it worked out really well. We were sort of a fun, lean team, and my childhood was pretty good for it. I do think it's harder when you're an adolescent and when you're an adult. It's ironic to me that it's the childhood of only children that people are most concerned about, when I do think that it's tougher the older you get. But, you know, I'm making similar calculations now in my own life. I live in New York. I'm a writer. I'm married to a photographer. So we're the idiots who chose low-paying careers in one of the most expensive cities you can live in, and we refuse to give it up. So, you know, this is one of the ways that we suffer for it, I guess. But mainly, you know, we're really happy with our kid. We're crazy about her, and we have a great time. You know, I spent the day with her on a train today coming back from her cousin's house, and the two of us just yapped it up, and I thought, this is pretty great. I don't need to mess with this to be happy. And it's really that feeling that I think leads us a lot, is this is good. We don't need to change it, so why would we?
Well, and even you who's, look at this, you're so comfortable with this. You talk about it on the radio, you wrote a book about it, but you still get branded with the selfish stigma that you've somehow made a selfish choice by having one child, that your mother made a selfish choice. And so it's not only the child that people worry about and sometimes judge, it's the parent, isn't it?
It's absolutely. And it's funny, I wasn't that aware of the judgment until I had a kid myself. As an only child, it wasn't something I heard that much. But once you're out there as a parent with just one kid and people ask you, where are your other kids or when are you having them, and you see their faces fall when you tell them, I'm not planning that anytime soon, it really churns something up. And it's hard to escape. You know, I too, even though I'm incredibly comfortable with this and, you know, as I guess we could say very out about it, talking about it on the radio. You know, I watched my daughter be a really great sort of big sister figure to younger cousins all weekend, and I saw how beautiful that is. And when she said to me earlier today, Mom, I want a sister, it's like,
uh-oh,
okay, we're going to have this conversation again. We have it all the time. But I do think that it's a conversation that she can have with me, and that's something I really appreciate.
Well, I want to get at some of these tags that only children have long gotten: lonely, selfish, maladjusted. Is there any recent science to back those up? What do we know now about those assumptions?
Well, there isn't. What we know now about loneliness is that only children tend to have a stronger primary relationship with themselves, which is actually like the best armor against loneliness you can have. All human beings are lonely, and so to be able to rely on yourself makes a big difference. That said, and this isn't something which is really borne out in the studies so much as the lived experience, I interviewed tons of people for this book, you know, if you're an only child living in a rural area away from other kids, that can be lonely. If you're an only child who gets homeschooled, that can be lonely. So for only children who go to school and can have other friends around, it doesn't make a difference that much. But for only children who are very much alone, that can be hard. In terms of selfishness, the most recent studies show that both in terms of selfishness and social adjustment, school is the great equalizer. It used to be thought that, you know, that siblings were necessary to kind of beat you up for the world a little bit. And people have found that your classmates can actually beat you up just fine, that there's enough abuse that happens in the classroom and on the playground, that the sort of learning that we get from conflict and competition with our siblings can actually play out with people who aren't related to us as well. Though there certainly is a learning aspect to that. But, you know, as recently as I think last year, 35,000 kids were polled about how many close friends they could name, and only children named just as many as any else. So, you know, furthermore, only children tend to have very, very strong, almost familial friendships. We tend to really cherish and nurture those relationships, because we know if we have a falling out with someone, they're not just going to be at the dinner table every night for the next week. We have to work on it. And so we actually tend to be very good at making friends and making very close, lasting friends.
Yeah, I love how you call that. You say only children are intimacy junkies.
Yeah, well, so, I know I am.
That rang a bell
for
with me,
or
too.
For worse.
Yeah. Do you think that this, I don't know, is it fair to call this prejudice? Against
sure.
only children, is that too strong a word?
No, I mean, I met someone just a couple weeks ago who was telling me a story. You know, she was saying, well, I was in a job interview a while ago, and it came out that I was an only child, and the person who could have hired me looked at me and she said, you know, I'm sorry, just on policy, I don't hire only children.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, what if we were talking about a different minority group? What if if she was talking about a racial bias or an age bias or a gender bias? That would be unheard of right now, or at least it should be unheard of right now, but it's really tolerated. And I'm, you know, I certainly don't believe that prejudice against only children is the same social issue is racism. But we at least know that one of them is wrong, and we accept the other one as a given.
So what do you think that families of only children, what kind of conversation should they have to tell each other that kind of I'm okay, you're okay?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, it's amazing. No one has thought to ask me that question in all of this time talking about this book. Because it's funny, I do feel like our conversation about parenting only children sort of begins and ends with don't do it, instead of how do we do it to feel okay about it. I think it's really important that parents know that only children are fine, or rather, we're not any less fine than anyone else. I mean, parents are going to screw us up whether we have siblings or not, and we'll screw ourselves up too. But I do think that it's really good for parents to know that articulating longing for more children is something that can be really hard on only children, that can make them really long for something they don't have and not quite feel normal or enough themselves. And to just, you know, be really upbeat, but without being too intense about it, which can be a hard thing to do. You know, one of the beauties of being an only child is that you get all of your parents' undiluted resource, which is not just money, but it's time and energy and attention. But too much attention can be overkill. And so I think it's just important for us to learn how to lay off a little bit and put our kids in the context of other kids, that, you know, that if you're around enough other kids, you know, okay, well, my kid's acting this way because they're five and not just because of who they are. That can be a very liberating thing, both for us and for our children. And I say this having read research, but also having to live with an only child who's five every day. And let me tell you, all five-year-olds have tendencies of the only child stereotype. But it's good to remember what's in play here. But mainly for parents, I think the most important thing, and this is a big part of why I wrote this book, is to protect their own happiness and to own that a bit. I mean, we have been in such a lockdown of parental self-sacrifice in this country.
It's
where
kind of that thing about a happy parent has a happy family and
yes,
a happy child.
I believe that. I believe that. My mother really believed that to be a good mother, she had to be a happy person.
And all right. Well, we'll talk more about that. More to come as we talk Only Children. We're talking with Lauren Sandler, author of One and Only. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also head over to the Central Time Facebook page and leave your comment there. We'll hear from you right after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Take Wisconsin Public Radio on the go wherever you go. Listen to our live broadcasts, our archived programs, and the latest from WPR News. Go to wpr.org/mobile app to download.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Lauren Sandler, author of One and Only, about the freedom of having an only child and the joy of being one. And we want to hear about your experiences. You can call us up at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. If you're an only, how have you enjoyed being an only? And if you have only one, how do you feel about that decision? And we'll go now to our first caller, Tara in Hastings, Minnesota. Hey, Tara.
Hi.
Hey.
I wanted to just thank Lauren for writing this book, because I have one son and I don't want any more children. And it's just such a taboo. I get pressure from everybody, my pediatrician, my in-laws, my parents, everybody, to have more. And I love how Lauren said, you know, the only discussion that's ever really brought up about how to parent only children is to not do it. So I just wanted to thank her for her insight and for just basically saying that it's okay.
Oh, thank you so much, Tara. When I hear from people that they get it from pediatricians or psychologists, I get so mad. So I really appreciate you reminding me that, you know, beyond the notion of a cultural issue that's generally out there or the uncomfortable conversations we have with family or friends sometimes, that there actually is, you know, an entrenched professional bias here, which is a real issue. And I really appreciate that. Thank you for calling.
All right. Thank you so much. Do you have any advice, though, for Tara about what to say to people when they do say things to you like that you'd rather not hear?
Yeah. it's such a hard, it's a hard situation to deal with. You know, I've had moments where the supermarket line, I've spit out, you know, economic factors about the rising inflation of parenting, and I've thought, oh God, that just doesn't get anywhere. So lately, I just smile and move on. But yeah, now I just want to push my book at people. What can I say?
All right. Well, good luck, Taryn. Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. We go to Kevin in Whitewater next. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Pretty good. We are the parents of one daughter, and not only is she an only child, but she's an only grandchild on one side of the family. So that really made it interesting right from the start. But the other thing about having an only child that I think is really cool is they can't blame it on anybody else in the family. Yeah, you know, such as one time our daughter
tried
to blame
something. That's one of the worst things about being an only child.
Oh, I thought it was just terrific. She tried to blame it on the dog one day, and I'm like,
I don't think so. The buck.
Yeah. So who's responsible when the kid has an issue? You know, I guess you know you can't pass the buck if you're an only child.
It's true.
Yeah, but then again, with only one child, you get to spend more of your resources and time on that one person instead of, you know, having to worry. You know, personally, I've got two brothers, and I couldn't imagine having any more than one child because you just want to spend so much time with one.
Right. I've heard that argument from other parents, Kevin, who went on to have more kids, but they couldn't imagine loving any child more than that one, and that led them to want to stop right there. And some people do. So I don't know. But then I don't know. How do you think about that, Lauren? Have you heard that before? Sometimes people think that their love is complete with that one child.
Yes, I hear that from a lot of people. And it's something I feel myself, and I know my parents felt themselves. But, you know, I've also watched so many friends have second kids or third kids who have felt that too. And then they really love that next kid. And so I think it's amazing how much capacity for love that we have, way beyond what we can ever imagine. And so I don't know. I think that it's hard to make a decision based on that, but I think that it's also okay to trust yourself. And if you know yourself and you know that's how you feel, and the only reason that you would feel compelled to have another kid is because you feel like it's the right thing to do, because you don't want to be a selfish person and the world has told you that, or you don't want your kid to be messed up and the world has told you that. I want people to have just confidence in being happy where they are.
Well, I want to get to, before we're through here, one more question that I think is an important one that you raise, that there's so much talk lately of a work-life balance and having it all. And we're finding, you know, with the economy, resources, you know, really having it all is getting harder and harder to do, if not becoming impossible. How does this idea of having only one child factor into that discussion?
Oh, to me, it is huge. And it has been just gobsmacking to me that it's been absent in this having it all conversation. To me, the answer to the having it all question lies, frankly, in family policy that we don't have, but the rest of the world gets to have. You know, we don't have the support in America that exists anywhere else. And I don't just mean what the EU looks like. You know, we're ranked for third or fourth worst family policy in the world. We're only bested there by Liberia and Suriname. We tie with Swaziland. That's how bad it is. And yet, in our country, we say you need to have more kids, you need to love it more than anyone else, and we're going to help you less than anyone else. So what this does is it puts the impetus on our individual decisions so much more, which doesn't mean that in other countries people aren't having only children based on the same calculus. You know, right now it's a month ago, the UK reached half only children. And in Asia, it's obviously huge. In Germany and Austria and Ireland, it's a really growing phenomenon everywhere. But we are the place in which it, I think, makes the biggest difference, because we have the most to do as parents with the least support. And because of that, it feels like, okay, well, what if you do work more? What if you actually, God forbid, want to do something beyond just live your life at home and at the office? I mean, it's always so interesting to me that we call it work-life balance. That's rarely what we're talking about. We're really just talking about work-parenting balance. You know, work-life balance never takes into account what if you want to have cocktails with a friend or go to the movie or, you know, have dinner alone with your husband or, God forbid, take a walk by yourself or read a novel, all things that I didn't stop wanting to do just because I had a kid. And I think that if you have one kid, not only are your resources undivided between more children and you can therefore devote them to your one child, but you can actually save a little bit for yourself. And if that's how we get the selfish brand as parents of only children, I think that, you know, I'm okay with parental selfishness. I also think that having those additional resources and some more time allows us to be more active as citizens and more active in our communities. You know, it's ironic that we don't have better family policy because, of course, all the people who would advocate for that are too busy taking care of their kids and working all the time. So it's really hard to make our society look a little bit more like what I think some of us might really benefit from because we don't have time for that sort of civil action. We don't have time for an engagement beyond our to-do list at work and at home. And I think that this is a way of opening that up. That doesn't mean that I think that everyone should have one kid. I think that people should really do what they want. But I do think that if what you might want is to have one, or if that's a choice that your body has made for you and you're feeling lousy about it, there's a lot of freedom in there and there's a real benefit in there. And that's something that we could actually start celebrating instead of demonizing.
Well, Lauren, it'll be so interesting to see if you start changing things with your book. And I appreciate you being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That was Lauren Sandler. Her book is called One and Only, The Freedom of Having an Only Child and the Joy of Being One.
Coming up in just a minute, we'll talk about party hands, vampire students, and biffles. Now, if that didn't make a lick of sense to you, don't worry. Language expert Grant Barrett is here to define some new and interesting words. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow morning at 7 on The Joy Cardine Show, Joy will get two perspectives on school voucher funding in the new state budget.
And now here's Kristen Durst with a check of our latest headlines.
President Barack Obama calls it one of the crowning achievements of his predecessor, George W. Bush. Obama is talking about a program funded by the United States aimed at stopping the spread of HIV and AIDS in Africa. He spoke today in Tanzania, where the White House says he and Bush will meet tomorrow at a wreath-laying ceremony at the site of the 1998 bombing of the U.S. Embassy that killed 11 people. A judge is allowing a San Diego area school district to teach yoga. The judge is rejecting the claims of disgruntled parents who called it an effort to promote Eastern religion. Judge John Meyer ruled today that yoga is a religious practice, but not the way that it is taught by the Encinitas Unified School District at its 9 campuses. Wisconsin Supreme Court has named 2 new members to its Committee of Chief Judges. The court appointed Rock County Circuit Court Deputy Chief Judge James Daly and Judge James Duvall, who serves both Buffalo County and Pepin County Circuit Courts, to the panel. Their appointments will take effect next month.
Thanks, Kristen. You'll hear more news coming up at 5 o'clock. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Time for some words now. Our next guest scans the media and the way we talk to find new words and phrases, and he's here to tell us what they mean.
Grant Barrett joins us from the studios of KPBS in San Diego. He's co-host of Away with Words, which you can hear Sunday mornings at 9 on the Ideas Network. And Grant, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys.
Well, Grant, I've got to tell you, I looked up a new word today when I was looking for the right word to describe you. I didn't know what the word was for someone who loves words, and it turns out that word is logophile.
Logophile, yeah. I thought you were going to say nerd.
The word
or
nerd. The word nerd.
The word nerd.
But I'm a higher class of logophile. I'm a lexicographer. I make and edit dictionaries.
Nice. Well, you're a high class for sure. Well, when did you first fall in love with words?
Well, I wanted to become a better writer. This would be back in the early 90s when I first went to university. And I found myself joining a group called the American Dialect Society, which is made up of the premier linguists and lexicographers of our age, grammarians, professors of English, that sort of thing. And it turned out that sitting at the knee of these people, sometimes literally I'd go to conferences and sit on the floor because there weren't enough chairs, was a great way to learn. And so here I am 20 plus years later putting that knowledge to work.
Now, you've collected some words and phrases for us, and we'll get to some of them in just a minute, but where do you go to look for new words?
Well, it's a lot of reading, a ton of reading, and also I've got a little trick. I use email alert services like Google Alerts and a couple of others. where I have them look for special phrases that are collocated to new words. And what that means is if you're a journalist, you've kind of got these standard ways of introducing words in your writing. So you might say, known in common parlance as, or in police talk it's called, or scientists refer to this as, and there's those particular constructions, refer to this as, or parlance. And I can just do an alert for the word parlance alone, and every day turn up dozens of words that reporters have identified in text as being new to them, and there's a pretty good chance if it's new to a reporter, it's new to me.
Well, you sent us some of your favorites. Why don't we start with one that you like a lot right now?
Oh, biffle. I think I like biffle the best because biffle is a fun one, and it's got a long history. A biffle is a best friend for life. So we've got BFF, which everyone knows. It means best friends forever, right? And this dates back to the 40s or 50s, much older than many people think. You probably would find it in your grandparents' yearbooks if you looked. And then fast forward to the texting generation, BFF takes on a new life. And then a little bit of modification, and people take that initialism, BFF, and turn it into a word. It becomes biffle. And then they kind of reanalyze it and come up with new meanings for it. And some people say it means best friend for like ever, which is another way. But so biffle.
And is this something you think we'd only see in print, or are people actually saying this out loud?
That's a great question, Robin. It's because people are saying it out loud that it changed. It's because we needed a way to say BFF without sounding kind of lame, right? And biffle sounds a little better than BFF.
Well, that was the only one on your list I had heard of before seeing your list. Now, let's get some of the ones I hadn't heard on. I don't want to be someone known as having party hands, do I?
No, you don't. Veronica, you should move away from this man.
I am. There's a seat between us.
Party hands are, how should we say this, groping hands, roaming hands, particularly after a little bit of alcohol. And this is a British term, and it refers to these people who just cannot, stop themselves from grabbing other parts of other people's bodies.
We don't have those in America, right? Those are just
British things. Bum or whatever when they're not supposed to. Yeah, so party hands is a euphemistic way of saying roaming hands.
I really like put someone on blast, but I can't entirely figure out how to use it. Tell us about that one.
Let's do a little skit here. You want to do a little skit?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
All right. You two are married, and Rob says, I've made dinner, honey, and you go and you see in the trash that there are takeout containers, right, Veronica?
Uh-huh.
And you tell everybody about the takeout containers. He didn't make dinner. He bought that. It's from Applebee's. You have put him on blast by exposing his lie and, embarrassing him in front of others.
I got it.
So that's what it means. It's really about taking an essential secret that someone has and sharing it with other people, telling something that they didn't want to get out.
I want to put that story on reverse blast. There are many elements of fiction there. I want to emphasize that.
Well, you know, we're all actors in a way, right?
True, true. Good point. Let's see. We've got lots more. How about now this one's in the academic world, a vampire student. Speaking of running away cringing, should the professor run away from a vampire student?
Well, first, let's talk about the word vampire for a second. It's gone beyond a creature who sucks blood. And vampire in English now kind of combines with other words to make new compounds to refer to anything that kind of sucks the energy away. For example, you might have a vampire power. This is the power that, say, a TV uses even though it's turned off. It's still sucking a little juice out of the wall, right?
I heard President Bush used that phrase.
He may very well have. It's definitely part of the green movement to stop your devices from consuming power when they're supposedly off. Well, what we have with the vampire student is a student who sucks the energy out of a teacher's time and schedule and patience. This is the student who always wants to negotiate a grade. This is the student who always has to come back and question the syllabus. This is the student who always comes to office hours, the one who always wants a letter of recommendation, the one who is always there with a hand raised, just taking far more of your time than anyone else in class. That is a vampire student.
Has vampire become one of those words that you can kind of stick on the front of everything, say vampire co-host?
Hey, well,
just as a for instance, you know,
it's what we would call a combining form. You can make really interesting compounds out of it,
and it's never good,
right?
No, not really. Not unless you're that student who's getting all the extra attention, you know, getting the most out of your student fees.
Unless it's like vampire co-host, like really sexy, like the movie Vampires these days.
I haven't
we probably
met
shouldn't
any of
go
those
there.
In public radio, but there could be a first.
There's a reason we're on radio, isn't there? What I was curious about, Boston Arm. Tell us about that.
This is not that common, but I liked it for just the way that we use slang. And I specialize in slang, so I'm really attentive to this. We use slang to characterize other people, but we often use slang to characterize ourselves. And in Boston, some people call the Boston arm, it's when you have a perfectly working turn signal on your car, but you wave your hand out the arm out the window instead to indicate what you're doing and where you're going. That's the Boston arm. So instead of just flicking the little switch there, you just wave your hand. I'm going this way, dude, or I'm going that way, dude. People have this whole attitude of kind of making gentle fun of themselves and their own behaviors, and I kind of like that. We see this often in language where people talk about having mañana culture. People talk about the California sense of time or the Chicago sense of time, and I'm sure that they do it in parts of Wisconsin. This Wisconsin attitude towards time, we make fun of being slow or fast or on time or late. It just comes up in a kind of civic pride way.
And you didn't, in investigating this, figure out why the people in Boston don't just use their turn signals?
You know, I didn't. I have a very weak theory that I could share with you. There's a company that makes prosthesis in Boston. It's called Boston Digital, I believe. And it's possible that that term lent something to this slang, but I couldn't prove it.
You know what? I completely relate to that. In summer, when I hang my arm out the window, I often would rather just point, but then it seems, you know, that that's not the etiquette. But maybe I could do that. And just it could
We're
be
all 2-year-olds behind the wheel, aren't we? We just want to point and have things happen.
That reminds me of the Madison left, where you go up and stop at an intersection and don't turn on your left turn signal until the light has changed and you're halfway through the turn.
That is now called a Madison turn.
Madison turn. I'm writing it down. And we have here in California the California roll or the California stop, which is not a stop at all, actually. You just like wave hello to the stop sign as you keep moving past it.
There's another good one, potato quality. That just has a nice sound to it.
All right. So this is something that annoys me, and I don't have many peeves, but I allow myself this one at least. It's when you get an image from somebody that has been saved and resaved so many times that it's just a blocky, JPEG-y kind of mess. Because every time you save a JPEG and other kinds of image formats, not all of them, but some of them, they recompress and they recalculate what the picture is supposed to look like. And you lose a little bit of data every time, and that's called lossiness. It's lossy. And so in the end, it's nothing like the original, which was probably crystal clear and beautiful. It's chunky or mushy. It looks like, you know, colorful potatoes with lumps in them that haven't been beaten out. You know, that's potato image quality.
Now, it seems like the world of technology would be a word lover's dream because they're making new stuff. So they have to keep on coming up with new words for it.
Absolutely. But most of it's boring. It's, you know, it's the ZX5 or the L24 and some weird brand name that somebody came up with because he was an engineer. Don't let your engineers do your naming. Probably better to ask the front desk people.
Good idea.
There's a word, actually a phrase on your list that I feel pretty confident that maybe our producers don't even know. They're constantly using phrases that Rob and I don't know. I bet they don't know on the reg.
Reg.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe they do. If they
yeah, they don't know it. They're shaking their heads confusedly. So we got one up on
the
them.
Reg, R-E-G.
Yeah, on the reg, and it just means regularly. And there's a show called Eastbound and Down on HBO. I've got my producer over here is giving it a thumbs up. It's hilarious. It's about this baseball player at the end of his life. He's a joke, but he's trying to make the best of being a joke and trying to straighten himself out. And he uses on the reg and all this other slang and you know, trying to stay cool. But the truth is, it's like 10 or 15-year-old slang, and that's exactly what Kenny's problem is. He never quite realizes that he's not as with it as he thinks he is.
Now, here's one maybe reflecting social changes in the way we think. CIS, C-I-S. What is that?
Well, you'll find this usually attached as a prefix to the word gender, cisgender. And what this means is that you identify with the gender to which you were born, as opposed to, say, being transgender, where you wouldn't identify with the gender to which you were born. So if you're cisgender, I'm a man, and I'm comfortable with being a man and identify as being a man, I'm a cisgender man, right? And this comes up in conversations of sexuality online, particularly in these big discussion forums, say a subreddit or something like that, or a metafilter or something like that, where you don't know the sexuality and the gender and how people perceive themselves, and you've kind of got to be considerate when you're talking about issues of dating and family and even medicine, that sort of stuff. So you say, well, as a cisgender man, I believe X, or as a cisgender man, I've never had any experience with Y. And in that way, you position yourself very clearly without having to explain at length what you mean.
Wow. Oh, isn't it exhilarating learning all these new words? I mean, do you actually use them in your daily life once you've learned them like this?
Yeah, I do. That's why it's kind of weird to talk to me. Yeah. But the thing is, so with that last example, what happened to us? All three of us here and everybody listening, we had an introduction into somebody else's way of thinking. It was a small one, but it can serve as this on-ramp to other ideas, other parts of culture, and other ways of thinking.
I wonder, do you ever go on listening field trips? I could see just spending time, say, at a mall or something like that. And just, I mean, not being trying to be obtrusive or creepy, of course, but just trying to catch the language people are using as they walk around or as they work behind the counter or things like that. Is that a good source for new words for you?
It is. It really is. It's not as easily searchable as the online text methods, but you have to be out there being kind of a basic field work. And this is something that on Away with Words, we encourage our listeners to do, to try to pay attention to the speech around so that you can get a little understanding of what's happening. Yeah, absolutely. Even if it's at line at the bank or you're going to the county fair or what have you, you pay attention to these different collisions of language. This is where we get the most interest. Person A is from, you know, Wisconsin. Person B is from, say, Los Angeles. They meet in the same place at the same time, and they're not speaking the same language. That is interesting.
You know, I used to feel like Saturday Night Live was the biggest conveyor of getting new words popularized. What is it now? Is it just the internet?
You know what's had a really long run in it? Two shows, South Park and The Simpsons, really have a long history of dropping catchphrases into language and kind of surreptitiously, but it's on the repeat cycle that they really have their second win and they really kind of push them through. The internet is good, but it's so fractured. We go find people like ourselves and maybe don't always cross that cultural barrier to encounter other kinds of people. But I would say television is still really strong at that. It's still very good at taking a new word and pushing it out there.
The Simpsons have really embiggened the English language, if you will.
They have indeed. Yes, that is a perfectly cromulent word.
Well, I think we've got some new words to kick around the office, Rob. Mm-hmm,
definitely. Definitely.
Well, that was Grant Barrett, co-host of Away with Words. Grant, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fun.
It was my pleasure.
And coming up, there's been a lot of talk about how our internet activity can be tracked by the government and private companies. Our next guest has advice for us on safer online communication.
That's going to come up after we check in on the latest news here on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is the Ideas Network.